Welcome to the Omfit podcast.
Good day, everybody. This is David Marsh at Omfit, and this is the latest in a series of podcasts that we're doing with people who've got something really interesting to say on economics and finance. And today I'm talking to two gentlemen who are the authors of a book which has really been taking the financial world by storm. It's called The Great Demographic Reversal, Aging Societies, Waning Inequality, and an Inflation Revival. And it's by Professor Charles Goodhart, who is a denizen of the London School of Economics, where he's been associated with the Financial Market Group for many years. He's now Emeritus Professor. He's been at the Bank of England as well for many years on different assignments, including at the Monetary Policy Committee. And Manoj Pradhan, who is an aficionado of world finance and somebody who's worked as the head of the global economic section at Morgan Stanley and now runs an organization called Talking Heads Macroeconomics based in London. And you've jointly written this book, which seems to have got an overwhelming amount of publicity. And Jens Weidmann, the president of the Bundesbank, has mentioned it twice in successive speeches. So that must be either a very, very good or a very, very bad factor. But I think it's a good factor. First of all, Charles, if I could just ask you then, you're challenging the notion that inflation and interest rates will remain low for years to come. Why exactly are you doing that?
Thank you very much, David, for the opportunity to talk about our book. Basically, we start by arguing that the ability of central banks to achieve their inflation target in the years up to the great financial crisis was not actually very difficult, in the sense that it was accompanied by continuing downward trend in nominal and indeed in real interest rates. So although the monetary policy regime from the 90s onwards, when we got central bank independence and inflation targetry, was much improved on what had gone before, it wasn't the only force leading to low and steady inflation. Instead, what we argue is that over the 30 years or so before 2010, what was happening was that there were two very strongly disinflationary trends. The first one was globalization, whereby a huge additional amount of relatively low wage but quite efficient labor in China and in Eastern Europe became available for any employer who could move their production of goods or services from a high wage to a low wage area. And besides that, there were some very, very favorable demographics in many of the countries, the advanced economies of the West and indeed in China, where you got a increased share of the population, in the working age population, and an increased participation within the working age population of women actually within the workforce rather than staying at home and doing domestic chores. Now, our argument is that these disinflationary forces are actually now reversing quite sharply. There's going to be a relative increase in the share of the old in our population, and the proportion of those in working age population is going to decline. In some cases, it's actually going to decline absolutely as well. And that is true in some of the countries which have grown fastest, like Germany and China. So our view is that the underlying structural forces which led to disinflation in the years up to 2010 about, are now reversing. And therefore, what was disinflationary over the future years is likely to become more inflationary during the next 3 or 4 decades, over which we can have a rough idea of how demography is going to pan out.
This hasn't really been priced into markets at the moment, has it, Manoj? I want to really jump ahead now and get ahead of the argument and find out what you think this is going to mean for the way people look at interest rates in not just the 1 year ahead, but in the years ahead. Do you think this amounts to a whole radical change in the way that financial market practitioners and investors should be viewing the world?
I think it'll be a dramatic change that almost no one is, one, prepared for, and number two, really happy to listen to, because it does not provide anyone with the comfort that we've had over the last 30 years that you could have a simultaneous bull market in bonds and equities, housing and almost every asset you can think of. That, under those circumstances, any portfolio that you constructed would have been absolutely fine. And if you had a balanced one, you would have done just as well. Now, I think what will happen is, given where 20 and 30 year interest rates are, those have provided a false signal, if we are right, to financial markets, just as they did in the 80s and 90s when they told us that interest rates would remain high at 8 and 9% for the next 20 or 30 years. We suspect that if we are right and interest rates start to rise, two things will happen. Number one, the financial market shock will lead to a wider issue about repricing of the path of interest rates, asset prices, and inflation in the future. And number two, that repricing will have growth effects, which means central banks will have to come in and try and decide whether that financial shock is doing something salutary in bringing inflation down, or it's doing something dangerous in bringing growth down, in which case the central bank would have to move to protect growth. And we suspect that in most cases, it is going to be this latter story with central banks move ahead, which would only act as a pro-cyclical boost for inflation, making things difficult in markets.
Well, I want to get into the issue of central banks in a moment, because Charles, you're quite well known in saying that you think central banks are going to have to sacrifice some independence. But first of all, just staying on this issue of portfolio shifts, Charles, this seems to me to be pointing towards a massive downgrading in price and quality of the bond portfolios of many very large investors around the world, including, of course, central banks, but many other investors as well, if what you and Manoj is saying turns out to be correct. People talk about things like stranded assets, and they talk about downgrades in assets because of climate change. Could this be actually even more significant than changes in portfolio valuations due to climate change?
Yes, I think that outlook does suggest that markets have gone way ahead of themselves, and at some stage there is likely to be a considerable break in asset values over a wide range of assets. And the concern, I think, is whether markets having gone, in our view, far too far in one direction, that the break should be sudden and disruptive and actually lead not to inflation in that case, but to further deflation, which would mean that the central banks would have to step in and come back with much stronger reflationary forces. So, and the danger is, I think, that when the underlying trends are inflationary, you are faced with the alternatives of a greater degree of inflation than you would desire on the one hand, or potentially a disruptive break in asset markets on the other, neither of which are particularly attractive outlooks.
Could you comment on that, Manoj, particularly the idea that central banks would have to wade in, raise interest rates? You could be back to a kind of 1970s specter of low growth, high inflation and high interest rates. It would be a rather bad cocktail, wouldn't it?
It would be a very difficult one. If you look at the behavior of financial markets over the last few weeks, it gives you a little insight into what that is going to feel like. When the Republicans lost two seats in Georgia, and the prospect of a large stimulus package that would broadly be viewed at this stage as pro-cyclical was upon financial markets, bond yields started rising. The dollar was stronger. Equity markets did very well, particularly on the small cap side, which shows the effect of the incoming administration. And it took a considerable amount of communication from the Fed, from pretty much every FOMC member, to tamp down previous talk of tapering and to assure markets that what is likely to transpire is going to be a blip in inflation that will go up and then come back down. And they have said so with a great deal of confidence, which markets are taking them at face value for. I think what we are saying is that they're probably right in saying that the initial pickup in inflation will be because of base effects and the reopening of the economy. But with those structural factors that we are highlighting, it's unlikely that it will come back, in our view, back down. And that's when the rubber will meet the road. That's when financial markets will want to know, how are you going to deal with inflation and protect growth at the same time, something that central banks haven't had to do for the last decade. And I'm not really sure there is a pretty answer out there, because raising interest rates when you've got such high levels of debt creates particular sensitivity. And the effect on markets, given they're so integrated globally, can be quite widespread. So I don't think we're looking at a pretty picture. Maybe for the first year or so, I don't think we'll have to worry as much. But later on, when there's a day of reckoning, I think the story will be very different.
Just a very quick question on that, Manoj, before I then go back to Charles. I was going to ask you this. When do you think the day of reckoning will be? It won't be for the next year. Would you like to stick your neck out and tell us when we should be marking down D for doomsday in our diaries?
Well, there are two or three things that I've been thinking through. First is I don't think markets are totally unprepared for some action from the central bank in damping down volatility. So break-even inflation, which is the difference between nominal yields and real yields, the entire break-even curve is above the nominal curve everywhere. And this has at least a smattering of a belief that central banks may act in the future to prevent nominal yields, which finance borrowing, from rising too sharply. And that's their pound of flesh, rising break-evens at the expense of real yields. But our view has been that once the vaccination process reaches some point in which you can open your economy up, the fundamental drivers that we are going to argue through mean that within 9 to 12 months, you should start seeing inflation pick up. The market discussion will happen in advance of that. So I would stick my neck out and say, this is a 2021 story for markets, even though it may not be for inflation prints themselves. I think the debate will rise much faster.
Good. Ladies and gentlemen, you heard it here first. So, Charles, I want to get into the demographic aspects, because that's the fascinating thing about this book. Although you are a monetary economist, you don't actually go so much into the monetary side of this. Lots of other people have done that, looks at the rise in the money supply and so on. You're looking at it from a demographic and rather socio-political point of view. Can you elaborate on this issue about waning inequality, which is part of the book's title? And that's another area where you are against the consensus at present.
Well, it's actually very simple. And what has been happening is that a very large proportion of many countries' manufacturing production has been shifted from high-wage to low-wage economies. What then happens is that wages in the low-wage economies rise relatively fast, while wages of blue-collar workers stagnate, thereby driving up the attractiveness of populism and all that. On the other hand, in the advanced economies, those who have human capital, technical skills, managerial skills, good education, can take part in the new digital economy and all that, have done very well indeed. So that the difference between the highly educated, the highly skilled, and the wages to the less well-educated and low-skilled have risen dramatically. And as the demographic forces reverse and globalization goes into retreat, those same factors will also reverse. One of the points that we make in the book is that because of the benefit to the low-wage economies, China and Eastern Europe, and Asia in particular, world inequality is actually now going down for the first time since about 1750. And in many ways, that's got to be regarded as a very good thing if you treat all people being of exactly the same weight. Because what happened in 1750 until about 18th century was that the Industrial Revolution took place in the Western economies. Europe, North America, Australia, etc., bounded ahead, while populous Asia remained mired in subsistence agriculture. And in the last 20 to 30 years, that has changed really dramatically. And so between country inequality has declined really very, very sharply, whereas within country inequality rose, particularly in the advanced economies, for the reasons that I've just indicated. But now with the reversal of these underlying demographic trends and globalization, what was offshored may increasingly become onshored, and there will be more jobs, particularly in caring for the aged, for those with relatively less educational skills. That's one of the reasons why even within country inequality is going to decline from now on.
Yes, and this is quite a change. It does, of course, assume, doesn't it, that there is not a major immigration into, say, Europe from countries like the Middle East or Africa with low-skilled, low-wage workers coming in and flooding the market because they all want to work in care homes. Could you just quickly just bring in this issue about immigration? Because, of course, that could change the balance, couldn't it?
And I think you've only got to mention that to see how politically implausible that is. And the concern about immigration was a major factor in the rise of the more populist right in countries like the USA, Italy, UK in particular. And the degree of immigration that people found politically unattractive was actually very much smaller than would be needed to offset the demographic trends about which we're talking. So, and we take the view, which I think is pretty generally accepted, that the degree of migration of that scale is simply politically, under present circumstances, impossible.
What about the other issue, Manoj, though, regarding inequality, which is always a bit of a hot potato? Pensions and the incomes of the up to now have been relatively better off retirees. What's going to happen to them? Because under your joint thesis, there are going to be more and more old people and their incomes are going to be squeezed vis-a-vis the young, able-bodied people who will be looking after them. Is that going to lead to some sort of political revolt as well? Because old people do tend to have quite a bit of political clout. They go to elections, they take part in elections, they're quite vocal, even though they're old. So what's that going to do to the socio-economic mix in advanced countries?
It's a great point you made, David, and there is undoubtedly some friction further on ahead. I think, like you mentioned, the key difference with the elderly protecting their interests is they don't take Molotov cocktails, they go to the polls and make sure that no administration that comes in is going to work against their interests. So clearly, with their ranks burgeoning and rising over a period of time, the ability of governments to act to actually reduce the benefits that they have available to them from here on is going to be quite difficult. Just two simple examples. One is that we have moved from defined benefits to defined contributions already. But from there to reduce the size of pensions, I think, is going to be a very difficult task. And the second is any attempts by governments to raise retirement ages and thereby reduce their own burden and own contribution to the pension systems have been met rather vociferously in every country that you can think of, whether it's emerging or advanced. And so that channel, I think, is open only for voluntary use if you wish to work a little bit higher. What is going to happen is that the labor force shrinking and hence gaining in labor strength, economic strength, is going to demand higher after-tax wages. And there'll be help by a little bit of the increase in productivity that we think is going to come along. And the balancing factor will be their improved strength. If they had very weak bargaining positions as they've had in the last 30 or 35 years, the inequality story would have been very difficult to justify. But the fact that they will be gaining in strength, economic bargaining strength because of their smaller numbers, allows them to use that economic strength to their own advantage.
We're getting towards the end now, so I just want to ask you both about the results of all this. Charles, you have been making a name for yourself over the years talking about central bank independence. You seem to be saying that they might be tempted indeed to flex their muscles in the face of higher inflation by putting up interest rates because that is their duty. Are you saying that they are going to run into a tremendous amount of flack as a result of this and will be more or less put back in their box? You've made yourself famous by saying on several occasions central banks should have enjoyed the time of their independence over the last 30 or 40 years. It was nice while it lasted. Could you elaborate on that, please, Charles?
Well, yes, I know for these last 30 years, central bankers have been the best friends of ministers of finance because they've brought down interest rates sufficiently to completely offset the rise in debt, with the result that the debt service ratio is no higher today than it was 30 years ago, because they've done so much for ministers of finance. No wonder there's been no sort of conflict between the politicians on the one hand and central bankers on the other. If we're right, the conflict will start again, and of course it will be much more severe because debt ratios are now very, very much higher than they were back in the 70s and the 80s. And there's some people, some among the central banking fraternity, state that if inflation should come, we know how to deal with it. And that is a remark of extraordinary complacency. It took a great deal of courage for Volcker, Reagan, and Mrs. Thatcher to undertake policies to cut inflation off at the stem. And that was when debt ratios were about a third of what they are today. So if the central bankers start raising interest rates, the effect on the budget will be considerable, let alone the effect on asset markets in the private sector, where the debt of the non-financial corporates has also been jumping up by leaps and bounds. And under those circumstances, the politicians have many powers that they can wield outside of the ECB. The European Central Bank is protected by treaty, and if they decide to raise interest rates, there's virtually nothing that the politicians can do. Every other central bank is actually a creature of the legislature, and what one legislature can do, another can undo, apart from the fact that the politicians have, in those countries, control over the appointments to the governor and to the members of the Monetary Policy Committee, and through that appointment, they can usually bend the central bank to their will. And if they can't do it through appointments, they can do it through act of Congress or act of Parliament. Ultimately, the politicians have the whip hand, and there is a limit to the extent that central banks can infuriate them by undertaking policy measures which the politicians do not like for electoral and political reasons.
I just have a specific question on this, Charles, to you before I'll put the final question to Manoj. The specific question is the United States, which is, after all, the most important economy in the world and with the most important central bank. Are you saying that because you have now Janet Yellen, who knows everything there is to know about the Federal Reserve as Treasury Secretary, you've got Jay Powell, who would like to be, no doubt, given a new mandate from February 2022, are you saying that the Reserve is just going to play ball during 2021, even though there may well be indications of inflation rate in the United States of, say, 3, 4, maybe even 5%. Are the Federal Reserve just going to be quiescent because Jay Powell will know that it's not going to be good for his career prospects if he leads a rise in interest rates this year?
Well, for the next year, they will both be quiescent and state that this is their own policy, because with average inflation targeting, the Fed actually wants inflation to be above target. It won't be unless inflation really kicks in over about 5% that they will start worrying. And so it's not likely to be before the summer of 2022 that we will actually see any gaps opening up between the Treasury and the Fed. And the Fed is taking the line increasingly now that initially any rise in inflation will be a very short-term blip, will dissipate fairly soon. So the key or period is likely to be the second half of 2022 if indeed inflation does remain above target, as Manoj and I tend to think. Though, of course, we don't have a crystal ball, and it's perfectly possible that we may be wrong. And one of the fascinating features is that never in history have the two main theories of what determines inflation. On the one hand, the monetary view that inflation is always and everywhere a function of too much money chasing too few goods, and what you might describe as the Phillips curve view, that inflation is a function of the balance of demand and supply in the labor market. Never ever have these two forces been in such, tending in such diametrically different directions. It'll be fascinating to see on which side the future actually tends to fall.
Well, this is my final question to you, Manoj, given the fact that this is not a consensus view, or at least hasn't been a consensus view up to now. Have you found, even since this book was published, I know you spent years thinking about it, but even since it was published last year, have you found a shift in the mainstream profession moving towards your view, which might have been thought rather outlandish a year ago? Where do you think the mainstream is now? Have you had lots of hate mail from people defending the idea that inflation is going to be low for 50 years?
Well, I think there is some subtle sign of at least a grudging willingness to listen to the argument. The feedback is still broadly twofold. One is a set of people who think, well, this is something that we should consider, and what's changed their minds, I think, which is not really fundamental material, but what has changed their minds is after the sharpest decline in GDP growth that we've seen in 2020, there has been no deflation. And clearly that's partly, it's not a macroeconomic story, as we all know. It's because the CPI basket has moved to a COVID basket. But nevertheless, I think that has allowed some people to think that things are changing. The second thing that has allowed them to think a little bit more freely about this is what Charles has said, is the extraordinary divergence between monetary aggregates, 25% growth in US M2, a sharp rise in Japanese money growth, and even euro area running around 10% while output gaps are so deeply negative. They're willing to consider it at least as a hedge against their main portfolio positions. So I think there is some grudging acceptance. I think the clearest signal that people are willing to think about these kind of moves is, as I said before, the shape of the break-even curve versus the nominals curve. Should that divergence increase in the favor of break-evens, I think we might take it as a little bit more evidence that things are changing a little bit. And I would watch the 30-year yield very carefully, because if you look at the broadest size of the market, credit markets are absolutely gigantic, and they're not going to sully themselves with anything trivial as break-even and real yields. But they will think about where the 30-year yield is and start thinking about that as a signal. So I think things are becoming a little bit more acceptable, but nowhere close to what we need them to be.
Good. We'll wait to see what another year of people reading your book does. We'll leave it here. This will not be the last time we speak about this, for on fifth, the revival of inflation is really going to be one of the big themes that we're covering in 2021. Thank you very much for this fascinating discussion, Charles Goodhart of the London School of Economics and Manoj Pradhan of Talking Heads Macroeconomics. May your book, which is a fascinating read, a riveting read, a timely read, may it have great success. Thank you very much for talking to me, and look forward to the next time when we'll be discussing all these themes in an OMFIF podcast.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.